ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते
वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
Reading text 31 from Canto 6, Chapter 17. This is Lord Shiva speaking to Parvati.
Vasudeve Bhagavati Bhaktim Udvahatam Rinam Jnana Vairagya Viryanam Nahi Kashchid Vyapashrayaha.
And word for word.
Vasudeve.
Vasudeve.
To Lord Vasudeva Krishna.
Bhagavati,
the Supreme Personality of Godhead,
Bhaktim,
love and faith in devotional service,
Udvahatam,
for those who are carrying, Nrinam,
men,
Jnana Vairagya, of real knowledge and detachment. Viryanam, possessing the powerful strength. Na,
not.
He, indeed. Kashchit,
anything.
Vyapashrayaha,
as interest or shelter.
Translation. Persons engaged in devotional service to Lord Vasudeva Krishna have naturally perfect knowledge and detachment from this material world. Therefore, such devotees are not interested in the so-called happiness or so-called distress of this world. Purport by Srila Prabhupada.
Here is the distinction between a devotee and a philosopher who speculates on the subject matters of transcendence. A devotee does not need to cultivate knowledge to understand the false or temporary existence of the material world because of his unalloyed devotion to Vasudeva. This knowledge and detachment are automatically manifested in his person, as confirmed elsewhere in Srimad Bhagavatam 127, same beginning part of the verse.
Vasudeve Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Prayojataha Janayati Ashu Vairagyam Jnanam Chayadahaitukam.
One who engages in unalloyed devotional service to Vasudeva Krishna automatically becomes aware of this material world, and therefore he is naturally detached. This detachment is possible because of his high standard of knowledge. The speculative philosopher tries to understand that this material world is false by cultivating knowledge. But this understanding is automatically manifested in the person of a devotee without separate endeavor. The Mayavadi philosophers may be very proud of their so-called knowledge, but because they do not understand Vasudeva, parentheses, Vasudeva Sarvamiti, they do not understand the world of duality, which is a manifestation of Vasudeva's external energy. Therefore, unless the so-called jnanis take shelter of Vasudeva, their speculative knowledge is imperfect. They simply think of becoming free from the contamination of the material world, but because they do not take shelter at the lotus feet of Vasudeva, their knowledge is impure. When they actually become pure, they surrender to the lotus feet of Vasudeva. Therefore, the absolute truth is easier to understand for a devotee than for jnanis, who simply speculate to understand Vasudeva. Lord Shiva confirms this statement in the following verse. So tomorrow morning is a restatement of what we just read. Vasudeva Bhagavati Bhaktim Udvahatam Rinam Jnana Vairagya Viryanam Lahi Kashchit Yapashrayaha. Persons engaged in devotional service to Lord Vasudev Krishna have naturally perfect knowledge and detachment from this material world. Therefore, such devotees are not interested in the so-called happiness and so-called distress of this world. Many things, nice points to make here. The verses preceding, we've been discussing in earlier classes, are Lord Shiva's explanation of detachment and the nature of attachment is that it causes bewilderment of living entity to accept what is not to be what is and what is to be what is not. The examples given, the happiness and distress that one experiences in a dream, whereas there's no real happiness or no real distress, it's just a dream. Or the Sanskrit term brahma, indicating thinking a snake to be a rope, or rope to be a snake, or a garland to be a snake. It's illusion. And accepting illusion to be reality, with that acceptance comes feelings. Oh, I feel afraid. Oh, I feel safe. And there's neither safety nor cause for fear. It's illusion. The nature of illusion has a very strong grip on the living entity. Just go a little bit for a moment to Brahma Samhita, because I mentioned I've been studying that, and the message is really just underscores the whole message. When Mahavishnu desires to create, there's the cyclical creation, manifestation, withdrawal of that manifestation in the annihilation condition, dormant within his body are all the conditioned souls, and that's a lot of conditioned souls, and at a distance is the external energy. He glances over the external energy when it's time to create. The glance carries the living entities in time energy. The undifferentiated pradhan becomes agitated by the living entities in time, and the undifferentiated elements start to separate out. And the first one that separates out is false ego. So before even the living entities do anything, their karma hasn't been activated yet, they're still in a dormant state of consciousness, but false ego is there. And creation doesn't begin yet. It's the entire separation of the Mahatattva is there. And so the elements are now available from the body of Mahavishnu, from the pores of his skin. He exhales and little seeds of universes, subtle seeds of universes, go streaming out of his body and enter into the Mahatattva. And as they enter into the Mahatattva, the gross elements, the five gross elements, start to expand the size of the universe. They cling to those subtle seeds of the universe. There's still no creation yet, but there's all these various elements. In the course of that description, the glance of Mahavishnu has a name. In fact, the glance of Mahavishnu is a person, and the name and the person are Shambhu. And directly in Brahma Samhita, it says that Shambhu is the personification of false ego. He is the embodiment of false ego. And that false ego of Shambhu is then transferred to the living entities. He is like the original progenitor or father, because the glance of Mahavishnu is like the activation or the original act of procreation. Mahavishnu never directly touches matter. Indirectly, through the agency of Shambhu, he contacts matter. And it's the male generative organ, specifically the language of Bhagavatam speaks in that way, contacting Pradhan. The term in Sanskrit is Adhara Shakti. I don't want to get too lost. The accommodating principle of matter, just like here's some, you know, a field. And depending upon the seed that's planted in the field, something is going to grow. But the seed is needed, and the land is needed, because otherwise you can have seeds just lying around and they don't grow without the accommodating capacity of the land or material nature. So there's these two elements. The seed, that's the living entity. The seeds of life are carried by the glands, and the male generative organ is Shambhu, and with it, false ego. He's the, again, the language of the Brahma Samhita is, he is the embodiment of false ego, and he transfers that false ego to the living entities. So even before we do anything, we're imbued or endowed with false ego, because you need false ego in order to do material activity. You need other things too, but you need false ego. And once entangled in the network of false ego, it's very difficult to get out. In fact, we can't get out on our own. And that's what's now back to the verse. The contrast between a philosopher, meaning one who is not a devotee, and a devotee, is that a philosopher is trying on their own effort to get out of the entanglement of material existence. And you know, whether it's Vedic philosophy, you know, that leads to impersonal conception, we're familiar with that, at least to some degree from Prabhupada's books. We're familiar with the tendency of the Mayavadi philosopher to use the power of speculation to determine reality. What is Brahman? And they use the method of negation. It's not this, it's not this, it's not this. The Sanskrit is neti neti. Na iti. not this, not this, not this. So, is the table Brahman? It's not this. Are the cartels Brahman? Not this. Is the air Brahman? Not this. Is the light in the sky Brahman? Is the earth Brahman? No, it's not this, it's not. What is it? It's not this. Definition by negation. I'll just say it the other way. No, it hasn't said what it is. It said what it isn't. Definition by negation. So when you negate and negate and negate and negate and negate, what are you left with? You're left with impersonal. So what's Brahman? It's impersonal. It's not this, not that. So here, for example, here there's variety. Well, Brahman must be without variety. Here there's person. Well, Brahman must be without person. Here there's individuality. Brahman must be without individuality. Here there's form. Brahman must be without form. Because it's not this, and it's not this, and it's this. By logic, inductive reasoning, the absolute is impersonal. Impersonal includes all those. No form, no qualities, no individuality. It's just homogenized blur. There's nothing distinct about it. The goal of the Mayavad philosophy is that they wish to merge into that. What's that? It's not this, it's not this, it's not this. The impersonal Brahman. That's their goal. Now, a little bit over here, something we don't read so much about is Buddhism. And because I've been visiting China, I meet a lot of people that are Buddhists, so it's important to understand like how they're thinking in order to help them accept Krishna consciousness. And I have found exactly as Prabhupada says that Mayavad philosophy is nothing but covered Buddhism. Because Buddha's teaching, the approach is different, but the end game is the same. The approach is, what is this? It's nothing. What is that? It's nothing. What am I? Nothing. And how do I arrive at that conclusion? By consolidating. I described a little bit yesterday this process of Zen, where you try to make your thoughts zero. You start with detachment from thoughts and detachment from things. No, gross and subtle things. Detachment, 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 detachment. Why? Because, according to Buddha's teaching, attachment to things brings suffering and illusion and falsity. And that's not reality. It takes you away from reality. So what's reality? It's not thoughts and it's not things, and just be situated in nothingness. Like, here's a little detail I learned. Like in Hinduism, there's lots of varieties. In Christianity, there's lots of varieties. In Buddhism, there's lots of varieties. But the most popular version of Buddhism in China and Japan is a kind of teaching that says if you're a good Buddhist, where do you go? You go to the land of something bliss, western land of bliss or something like that. And what's there? Buddha is there. And there's opulence and enjoyment. It's like heaven, kind of description. And there you learn how to enter into nothingness. When you're a really good Buddhist, you go to the land of bliss, the place of somethingness, and enter into the land of nothingness. You graduate. And your diploma is you enter into the void. Nirvana. But you don't go directly to the void, you go to the land of bliss, and learn, you get really trained up. So that's the goal. And you know, I've experimented a little bit. Is that the picture that you receive from Buddhism? Everyone says yes. Scholars say yes. Even the common people say yes. That's the picture. So you go from this land of struggle to the land of bliss to the land of nothingness. The goal is void, which is historically or chronologically, Buddhism came before Shankara. Now, Buddha, we know, he trashed the Vedas because people were misusing the Vedas for killing animals in sacrifice. So he said, I reject the Vedas. Follow this method of nonviolence. And the goal of the nonviolence is it's a gateway to come to the land of nothingness, to void. Historically, after Buddha, came Shankaracharya. And Shankaracharya took basically the framework of Buddhism and just used different language. It's the same conclusion, but it's the language of the Vedas. So he established the Vedas should be accepted and properly followed, and his message is the same as Buddhism. It just has different nomenclature, but it's the same program. So like Prabhupada, our second pranam mantra, nirvishesha shunyavadi pasyatya desha tarine. He's delivering the Western countries that are filled with impersonalism and voidism. Nirvishesh shunyavad, impersonalism and voidism. So if one is, now back to the text, if one is a philosopher, one is the best. Like, you know, go as far as you can go. Keep going, keep going, keep going. What's the farthest you can go? The farthest you can go, I mean, many people don't go that far. But the farthest you can go is negation. You can't enter into the realm of transcendence. You can say, what is transcendence? Well, it's not this. By philosophy. Buddhism or Shankara's teachings, either way. That's as far as you can go. Prabhupada was asked, what's the destination of a Buddhist, you know, from a Vedic perspective, besides, you know, their teaching? His answer was, the river Viraja. You know what the river Viraja is? It's the river that divides the spiritual and the material world. So on this side of the river is the material world, and then there is the river Viraja, and on the other side is the spiritual world. It's where the Brahma Jyoti begins and the vastness of the spiritual sky with the Vaikuntha planets and Goloka Vrindavan. That's on the other side. So the river Viraja is neither here nor there. That's where the Buddhists go, Prabhupada said. They enter the river Viraja. That's if they become perfect. And otherwise, process-wise, they're trying to withdraw themselves in a very austere lifestyle, like severe lifestyle. Good, serious Buddhist lives a very severe lifestyle of sense abnegation, denial of the senses, and, you know, beating the mind and detaching oneself from the world. Now, what's being spoken of here in this verse is that the process of devotional service, properly performed, brings one to that same position of detachment. This is the verse. Jnana vairagya viryanam. Jnana vairagya viryanam. Jnana is knowledge and vairagya is detachment. In the whole of the Vedas, you'll find this couplet, these two things. Jnana vairagya. Jnana vairagya. One follows the other. detachment follows knowledge, transcendental knowledge, not like university knowledge or academic knowledge. But transcendental knowledge leads to detachment. Transcendental knowledge leads to recognizing the temporality of duality and its distinction from me. We go back to that little Zen Buddhism practice. Detachment from our thoughts. And when progresses, there's something else besides the thought, and that's me. I'm the conscious self. It's a discipline to help bring attention to the self and not to the stuff outside the self. It's like who I am. And if you refrain from desire and impulse born of the modes of material nature, you can be situated, theoretically at least, in self-realization, situated in the self through mechanical process. Unfortunately, it's not our nature. We're active by nature. It's not our nature just to sit and do nothing endlessly. It's not our nature. We're active. We're social beings. And so as soon as that nice discipline is over and you start doing things, that detachment is lost. It's dissipated, like it's gone. And attachment, because it's not really a detachment. It's mechanical. It's like tightening a screw and tightening a screw and get that screw as tight as you can and then keep jiggling the machine and the screw comes loose. Because that's what happens when you move things around, that which fastens it together becomes loose. As long as we're in touch with matter and not consciously in touch with the Supreme, then the mind will be attracted to matter. So the solution, the Vedic solution, the Bhagavatam solution, is bhakti. By cultivation of bhakti, Vasudeva Bhagavati, bhakti yoga, prayojataha, by contacting Krishna through devotion to Krishna, two things. Attachment to Krishna leads to detachment from matter. We'll say the opposite. Slackening in one's attachment to Krishna leads to attachment to matter. Like inversely proportionate. This one goes up, that one goes down. This one goes down, that one goes up. It's a choice that we make. Do we want to be attached to Krishna, or do we want to be attached to duality? The happiness and distress program that was described in the previous verses. Delusion. Madness. And you know, the modes of nature have these symptoms. Because you contact matter and the modes of nature start to act. But if you're contacting Krishna, the modes of nature subside. It's really a choice. And the choice is facilitated by Krishna. Krishna sends messages, he sends representatives, he sends the process of devotional service itself. Great fortune to be engaged in devotional service, because it can take one out of material contamination. The whole realm of material existence can be terminated by contact with Krishna. And with that, the verse is saying, naturally, there's knowledge and detachment. Naturally, or like, it's like pulling a tissue out of a tissue box. You don't need to grab the whole tissue, you just take the corner of the tissue and you pull. What happens? The whole tissue comes out. Just because you've got a hold of the corner of the tissue. Just take a hold of this bhakti principle. And knowledge and detachment will follow. That's what the Bhagavatam is teaching us. And That's the practical reality for one who is properly practicing devotional service. Knowledge. I'll just read what Prabhupada writes here in the purport again. He says, this detachment, this detachment is possible because of his high standard of knowledge. But then he goes on to say he doesn't have to separately endeavor for a high standard of knowledge. He has to endeavor for devotion to Krishna. So when we're reading or studying, just like we're discussing Bhagavatam, it's a bhakti activity. It's not a knowledge acquiring activity. It's not, I've got my little information basket over here and I'm trying to fill up my information basket, so I got like a big information basket. Look at this, I've got a big one, lots of information inside. It's not that kind of process. It's a bhakti process. It's that which is going to, specifically and purposefully, that which is going to increase, facilitate, invigorate devotion to Krishna. That's the aim, the objective, the fruit. And when that devotion to Krishna awakens, those things that we've heard take on exactly the language that's in the verse. Viryanam. Virya means strength or power. One becomes powerful. So powerful that, like Haridas Thakur, allurement of the prostitute, and then later in the Bhagavad, Chaitanya Bhagavad is described, Maya Devi herself came to allure Haridas Thakur, and he was unaffected. Or another nice example is Markandeya Rishi, when he was tempted by Indra, by Cupid personified, and a whole bunch of dancing girls. They were doing their dance, and Cupid was firing his arrows, and Markandeya Rishi just smiled. And then Cupid realized, I've made a big mistake. I followed what Indra said to do, but this is a big offense, because he's truly a saintly person. He's not like one of us, where Cupid's arrow excites the living entity. That position of strength or of protection from the onslaught of Maya comes from devotional service to Krishna, properly performed, beginning with proper hearing, proper chanting, and proper carrying out of service according to what we've heard and chanted. Knowledge and detachment causelessly awaken. And one becomes powerful. Spiritually powerful. Spiritually powerful such that nothing can touch you. Here's a little anecdotal story. I know a group of devotees that go once a year to Udupi. Udupi is in South India, and it's the headquarters where Madhvacharya resided. And there's 9 temples, or they call them mutts, M-A-T-H-S. And there's a central one, Udupi Krishna. And then the other temples are other Lila avatars, Nrsinga temple and Vamana temple and Matsya temple, like that. And the devotees go there every year for because it's very peaceful, weather is, moderate in January. They go, it's like cool, nice. So there's like a couple hundred of them that they go there, and they've by going there every year and every year, they've developed a relationship with the priests. Because in each month there's a grahastha that does the management, and there's a sannyasi that does the teaching and training. And then they have like a gurukula where there's teachers under the sannyasi and so forth. It's like a whole structure, very, very organized structure set up by Madhvacharya. So, in the course of developing a relationship, they've had interactions, discussions. And one time they showed, "You're ever well wisher." You've probably seen that video, a documentary of Prabhupada's life. And after seeing the documentary of how Prabhupada started the Hare Krishna movement in the West, they commented, "We could never do that." Specifically, they were referring to the section where Prabhupada is in Golden Gate Park with a group of hippies, and they're dancing, you know, in different ways, and he's playing kartals, and the devotees are playing redanga, just having kirtan in the middle of a park in America. And they said, "We could never do that. Your Swamiji, he's very powerful. That he can withstand all of this glare of the material energy and not be moved by it. We could never do that." It's the Yukta Vairagya principle that Prabhupada engaged, and with that came protection, knowledge and detachment. Knowledge and detachment from the strength following behind bhakti. Prabhupada gives this example, very nice example. A queen in a palace. So the king has a palace and he has a queen, and he arranges for the queen to have different attendants, or the British term is ladies in waiting. So as the queen is moving around the palace, there's all these ladies following behind her to take care of whatever she wants. But Prabhupada says the queen is only interested in one thing, the king. She's not interested in all the comfort that can be provided by the ladies in waiting. But she has them so that if for service of the king there's something or something or something, they're there to take care of it. But she has only one interest. And in the superlative condition, it's but Vrindavan, where like there's this nice discussion in Chaitanya Charitamrita about the opulence of the goddess of fortune. Very quickly, in our Vaishnava calendar, we have the date of the Rath Yatra in Jagannath Puri. The return Rath Yatra is 8 days later, and right in between, 4 days after Jagannath leaves the temple, gets on his chariot along with Balaram and Subhadra, and they're taken along the grand road to Gundicha, signifying his return to Vrindavan. 4 days later, the deity in the temple of the goddess of fortune comes out of the temple in an angry mood, along with her attendants. They put her on a palanquin, they carry her, a big procession, you know, another kirtan, big thing, and they come to Gundicha temple, they set down Lakshmi, the goddess of fortune, and there's prayers that they recite in Sanskrit saying, "Return Jagannath to the temple now." And they have sticks, and the attendants of Jagannath come and they beat them. I mean, I don't know how seriously they beat them, but they beat them. Like this whole deal, because he's got to come back. He's my husband. He must come back. He's, you know, in a haughty mood. And so it's called Hara Panchami. So while watching the Hara Panchami festival, Srivas Thakur, who is Narada Muni, was in ecstasy. "Just see the opulence of my goddess of fortune. Her opulence is so much superior to the opulence of Vrindavan." And Lord Chaitanya heard, and he smiled. And he said, "Srup Damodar, what do you think of this? Is the opulence of the goddess of fortune in Vaikuntha vastly superior to the opulence of Vrindavan? What do you have to say?" And there's a long description where the opulence of Vrindavan is so vast, and so it's kind of summarized in those long verses that come at the end of the Govindam prayers. Shriya Kanta Kanta Kalpataravo Thrumas. Okay, so It's describing, the Brahma Samhita is describing in the beginning part and in that section, the opulence of Vrindavan, where even the land is Chintamani. All the trees are Kalpavriksha trees. All the cows are Surabhi cows. And they yield all desires. But the residents of Vrindavan, no problem. Because they don't have any desires other than serving Krishna. So whatever they want for serving Krishna is supplied. They're not thinking, oh, fantastic, now everything I want. It's everything for Krishna. So all the various flowers and fruits and things, that whatever the trees supply, it's for Krishna. It's a perfect arrangement. But so in that discussion, Srivas Thakur says, okay, I've been defeated. The opulence of Vrindavan is far greater than the opulence of Vaikuntha. Because the mood, why? The mood of the residents of Vrindavan is such intimate love for Krishna. So now, in the hierarchy of spiritual realm, Ayodhya is down somewhat, and Vaikuntha is down somewhat. Now we go down to the opulences in Brahmaloka, the opulences in the heavenly region, the opulences here, and the opulences in the hellish region. Everything is diminished, 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 diminished. Why? The intensity of love for Krishna, or the directing of our attention for Krishna. If one directs one's attention, just like look at Prabhupada's life, how much opulence did he have? He described, when I was a householder, I had some wealth, and now I have unlimited wealth. I gave up all my wealth. Krishna took away my wealth, and I gave it up, and now I have more wealth. And so much more wealth than any man has. But without any interest in sense gratification. No interest in for me. It's for Krishna. Little Prabhupada story. During the Radha Damodar days, Radha Damodar bus party, for a little while I was part of the airport party of the Radha Damodar party. Tamal Krishna Maharaj was, you know, in charge of the Radha Damodar bus program and Radha Damodar book distribution program. And he had a large number of devotees come to Mayapur for the Mayapur festival in, you know, as a rejuvenation, because Prabhupada wanted us to do that. So Prabhupada very kindly arranged a private darshan. And those of you that have been to Mayapur, you know the darshan room is quite small. It's like, you know, it's like from that, well, not even that far. I was going to say from this, the edge of the door to that wall, and then kind of like, you know, that's like that little rectangle. It's not big, it's smaller than that. So we were all crowded, like shoulder to shoulder, sitting in the darshan room, and Prabhupada's quarters was just behind. So there's a little doorway, and we were all seated, waiting, just chanting japa. And Prabhupada came out of his room and sat down at his little desk, because, you know, had a little thing to sit on, and his little desk, sitting cross-legged on the floor, like that. And Tamal Krishna Maharaj put a big stack of money, like $100 bills, and just put it right on the edge of the desk. And I was seated, like, you know, even closer than you are. I was seeing Prabhupada and how he was, you know, doing what he was doing. And I noticed that his eyes never went to that big stack of bills. I had the sense when I saw Tamal Krishna Maharaj put the big stack of bills on the desk, it was not intentionally so, but maybe subtly so, like buying Prabhupada's favor with a big stack of bills. It was $50,000 or something, like US. And that time that was like a lot. That was a lot. And Prabhupada didn't speak about it, didn't look at it, didn't mention anything at all. And then the darshan was finished, and he stood up. He was fully aware. He just wasn't going to be purchased by money. He turned to his, because I was right there, turned to his servant and said, please see that this Lakshmi goes into such and such accounts where he can print such and such book. And then he went to his room and he stopped and turned around and smiled and said, and maybe I can have honey with my meals. Went like that and went into his room. Meaning, a little sense gratification, haha. Because he had everything he wanted anyways. If he wanted honey, it's like, you know, barrels of honey would come into his room. It was not even the hint of something for sense gratification. That was his message. And he said it in a joking manner. Detachment is the natural fruit of attachment to Krishna. And as one's attachment to Krishna and serving Krishna becomes stronger and stronger and stronger, then opulence can come again and again and again and more and more, and one doesn't become overwhelmed unless there is a contemplation somewhere in there that let me be an enjoyer of the material energy. Here's another Prabhupada statement. This is from a Brooklyn temple, 1971 or 2. Prabhupada was describing the condition of a materialist and then contrasting with the position of a devotee. He said, for a materialist, they're very busy searching for sense gratification. Then one becomes a devotee. And what happens for a devotee is sense gratification comes and rolls at one's feet. Please take me, please take me. And Prabhupada went, no, I'm only interested in Krishna. And it happens. It's a test or a temptation or a challenge that Krishna brings. Prabhupada described like this. Krishna sees, oh, you want to come to me? Are you sure? What about a little tribulation? Is that okay? Are you still, you want to come to me? Yes, yes. Whatever tribulation. What about a little material enjoyment? How about that? Here's a little material enjoyment. The devotee says, no, I'm only interested in Krishna like this. Please take me, please take me. I'm only interested in Krishna. That detachment comes from attachment to Krishna. And without attachment to Krishna, guaranteed, there's going to be attachment to matter and affinity for enjoying matter. And when opportunity comes, what's the problem? In moderation. I'll end with this. When I was about 4 years old, 4 or 5 years old, my family moved from one place to another place. My father got a transfer of his job. So we moved from this place to that place. And when we moved to that place, the new place, the priest, my parents were Presbyterian, Protestant faith. So because they were Presbyterian over here, they notified that the new place, and that the priest came to see us, you know, like receive us at our home. Welcome to town. You know, welcome to our congregation. A nice gesture. And so he came, and being polite, my parents offered him something, you know, it was like Vedic culture, although I didn't understand at the time. Nice words, a place to sit, and some refreshments. So they said, would you like something to drink? Would you like coffee, or would you like some water? Or would you like some wine? And he said, I'd like some wine. And he started sipping the wine. And I remember my sister said, is that okay for a priest to drink wine? And his answer was, in moderation. And I was just, you know, 5, 6 years old. And I thought, this is ridiculous. and I didn't so much understand about, you know, boy-girl things and marriage things, but the light went on in my head and said, if moderation is okay, then he can be with another man's wife in moderation, and it's okay, as long as it's in moderation. That was my thought. So I didn't trust the man. Later on, some years later, they had to drive the guy out of town because he was in moderation associating with other men's wives. And it was like a big embarrassment for him and a big embarrassment for the town and a big embarrassment for the leaders of the church. They had to drive him out of town for his moderation. The teaching of the Vedas is not moderation. I mean, that which is according to the codes of Vedas is to be regulated, and that which is not within the codes of the Vedas is not to be regulated. We don't participate in that. At least for those who are serious devotees, like on the path given by our founder Acharya, the path back to Godhead. We don't in moderation, indulge. And from that, it's then on the strength of, I can't offer this to Krishna, so I don't do that. I don't eat things that's not offered to Krishna. I don't extend my senses, like the turtle, the tortoise, into the realm of material energy, unless there's some service to Krishna. And if it's not service to Krishna, no thank you. And with that comes protection, comes strength, comes spiritual strength. Follow. Comes from that. Spiritual strength. Directly in the verse. Jnana vairagya viryanam nahi kaschit vyapashrayaha ashrayaha ashra, shelter. The other things don't have shelter because you're full. It's like, you know, if the cup is full, you can't put something else in it. If your consciousness is full with thoughts of devotion to Krishna, other stuff isn't going to go in. There's no room for it. It's no thank you. I have no interest in other things unless it's for Krishna's service. Period. Not like, well, let me think about it. I have to contemplate this for a while. There's no, when that contemplation, we know from Bhagavad Gita what happens when you contemplate objects of the senses, you develop attachment to those objects of the senses. And then the chain reaction keeps going. It's really hard to put on the brakes when you contemplate. So it's just, it's much simpler at the very beginning just to say no thank you. In the beginning, maybe it's just the regulations of bhakti. I follow the regulations of bhakti. And from that comes purification. And with the purification, then the light goes on. Oh, here's why the regulation is there. Because it'll implicate me in material existence, which I'm trying to become freed from. It helps. It's like making wet wood dry wood, so it can ignite. We're like wet wood. We need the regulations of bhakti to make us less waterlogged, less contaminated by material existence, to enter into the realm of transcendence. And it's just come close to Krishna. Krishna is the fire. Come close to Krishna, you become dry, ready to ignite in the fire of devotional service. This is what Lord Shiva is teaching to Parvati here. Any discussion? Questions? She always has good questions.
In practicing bhakti, we do things, or we aspire for the goal or the authority of Krishna.
Yeah.
He wants us to come to honor our devotional service, always think of it, and so on. And the impulse of the part of the Buddhist far to come to that stage of perfection on what is the impetus or what is the authority to...
There's two different words. Impetus is frustration. Vitaraga vaya krodha. You know that verse from Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada speaks of krodha, the frustration. I'm so frustrated with material existence, let me out of here. To where? It doesn't matter, just let me out of here. So it's born of frustration. That's the impetus. And the authority is, they have their teachers and their teachings. Shankaracharya has the authority of the Vedas and his rendering of the Vedas according to his, you know, the spin. And the Buddhists, they have their Buddhist doctrines. Like in Chaitanya Charitamrita, the 10 teachings that when Lord Chaitanya met with the Buddhist and he defeated all 10, they have teachings. And that's their authority. Buddha said, I accept Buddha. That's my authority. Buddha said. But the different group says a different Buddha said. Like that. That's the authority. The impetus is, I want out of here. Not even necessarily like, I want higher consciousness. It's frustration. I don't want this suffering. And look anywhere and you see suffering. Subjectively and, you know, interpersonally, there's so much suffering in the world. What's the alternative? So there's teachings that connect the impetus, frustration. It's hard to sustain it because when the level of suffering goes down, my impetus goes down. And I feel complacent again. So it takes a lot of determination. But there's some power in even mechanical detachment or the pride in becoming something. You know, a spiritual person, and I get some perks that way.
Upon gaining this, they think there is
no greater gain.
No greater thing. Sometimes people who are familiar, not with bhakti, but with the impersonal school, they will sometimes question people or devotees who were like maybe guru or teachers, but are you realizing their definite description is that you won't know until you actually attain that. Nobody can know, you know. In other words, they don't know, they have to first do that and then they realize that. Whereas we have description from Rupa Goswami, so what is the state of perfection, what is the symptoms of, you know, the transcendentalism and so on. So I was just thinking that description of the bliss in the Bhagavad Gita, how do we see that? Who is Krishna? You know, he's speaking about the yogis attaining that, but how do we see that as compared to general Mayavadis, impersonalists, or Buddhists and so on? This perfection Krishna is describing. How do we...
Just that particular verse where there's no greater gain.
Yeah.
Well, I would say two things. Krishna, in Bhagavad Gita, is addressing different levels of spirituality or religiosity and spirituality, not just one. It's like the whole gradation. So any given verse might apply to some of those different gradations. In other words, somebody that's aspiring for heaven may think, one having attained this, there's no greater gain. So Krishna knows that that's not the ultimate gain, but he's encouraging those to become pious rather than being impious. You know, so the application of a verse has different readings than maybe, you know, than Krishna's necessarily his ultimate reading. Now, having said that, very kindly, Prabhupada takes every verse from the beginning to the topmost stage, which is actually what Krishna's intention is, to bring us to the topmost stage. But he's not bringing us to the topmost stage at once. He's bringing us gradually because persons are not so willing to go at once, otherwise they wouldn't be here. So the ultimate intention behind this word is, you know, attaining the shelter of Krishna in the spiritual world. Having attained this, there's no greater gain. That's the ultimate. But there's great, going back, there's gradations of how Krishna is encouraging different people who are in different states of consciousness. Certainly Krishna is not an advocate, you know, from chapter 12, he's not an advocate of impersonal conception of the Supreme. But such people, you know, the impersonalist feels there's nothing greater than this. There's nothing greater than becoming one with Brahman. Having attained, there is nothing greater. That's their conviction. So they feel encouraged in that way. But that's not Krishna's ultimate intent, which is your question. Negation is ultimate for them. But that's not Krishna's intention.
Is the verse, yes, chapter, each chapter where Krishna is saying, at least the translation is like that, there's no destruction either in this world or the spiritual world. Where is the question of destruction in the spiritual world? I mean, why is that?
Well,
phrase like that, no destruction in this world,
it's here's my sense of that. It's a compare and contrast kind of teaching. That is, it's like saying the souls are never come into being, have never come into being, and never will come into being. That's like squeaky clean, eternal. So similarly, spiritual progress is not lost even if you take birth again or if you go to the spiritual world. It's because it's spiritual. It's sat. This gain is sat. In contrast, compare contrast with gain that's temporary. Like piety. And going to the heavenly planets and enjoying for some time and exhausting the piety and coming back. Not that kind, the other kind, that which is never lost in this world or the next. Sat, like absolutely sat. Different than the other kind of gain. That's my sense of Krishna's teaching. Anything else? Okay, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.